This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Dwight Mullen grew up in South Los Angeles in the 1960s. Then, as now, it's a tough place to grow up. But he managed to find comfort and support at the Seventh-day Adventist school he attended. Dwight eventually became the first in his family to attend college. Pretty soon, Dwight became a teacher himself. One of his first jobs out of school was teaching public policy in Nigeria. Today, he's a political science professor at the University of North Carolina at Asheville. For a decade, Dwight has worked with his students on a State of Black Asheville project, an annual report on racial disparities in Buncombe County. Dwight's work led him to receive the UNC Board of Governors Excellence in Teaching Award in 2014, and Dwight Mullen joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. Let's take you back to South Los Angeles growing up. You grew up in the Watts neighborhood of L.A. What did that neighborhood look like when you were growing up?
Well, I lived on 104th Street, and we used to call 103rd Charcoal Alley. That was where most of the rebellion hit in 1965. And, you know, there was an alley that connected 103rd and 104th Street. And so when folk hit the stores, they were dropping things off in our front yard. And I have new school clothes the next semester, but you know, we were so well into Watts until we were one of the families that folk turned to, I guess, when help was needed.
Tell us about growing up, and again, you know, sort of what the neighborhood looked like leading up to that rebellion, and you know, kind of what it was like for you on those streets.
Well, you know, I was in elementary school and moving into middle school, and for me, that was the time when my first contact with LAPD happened. I remember being followed from the bus stop to home, being baited by LAPD. That was one of my first real memories of confrontation. I remember the gangs in Watts before the rebellion. They were called the Slawsons, and that was the biggest gang. And you know, it was something to be affiliated, because it meant that you couldn't really depend on LAPD to protect you, or L.A. County Sheriffs or California Highway Patrol or any other law enforcement agencies that overlap. You had to depend on local folk, and the local folk who protected you were the neighborhoods and the gangs.
Were you a member?
No, I was too young. I was much too young. My brothers, they were my protection through the gangs. They had affiliations.
And this is an interesting point. It's when, you know, when the local authorities and local, you know, social and political structures fail to provide for people, they just find another way.
Yeah, there was no choice. I mean, there just was no choice. I mean, if you were going to be safe and go to the store, or we used to call it getting jumped. If you weren't going to get jumped, people needed to know who you were and who had your back.
You talked about gangs, but there were other more conscious political ways of organizing. The Black Panthers were organized, and they were also delivering services.
Yeah, you know, right before Watts burned, there were political organizations that hardly get noticed now. And one of them was involving a boycott of the local grocery stores, because what we found happening, I remember my parents talking about this, and they were one of the folk who met and organized. They would get meat from the local chain stores that had been discarded, and then repackage it and sell it in Watts. One of my jobs as a kid was that I had to smell the food. I had to smell the meat before I had to bring it home, because I had to be sure it was fresh enough to eat. And that was happening before. And then when it burned, it was probably, I think, looking back on it, one of the safest times I ever had in Watts was when there were no law enforcement. When there were the National Guard had not, you know, the Army had not been sent in yet. And I remember there was just not any. There was no danger. There was no gangs. Nobody was doing any jumping. It was just one thing. It was pretty safe.
What about you talked about these other organizations and the fact that these are probably white-owned businesses as well, and we're going to get to the State of Black Asheville later on in our program and talk about some of the things you find. But ownership of property, ownership of businesses is huge, and it was very important back then as well.
And not only was it almost completely white-owned, but it was also they wouldn't hire from the neighborhood. I remember looking to be a bag boy. I couldn't even carry the groceries out from the local store. They just would not hire, and they wouldn't, you know, the banks would not give you money to start your own business. And then after the riot, after folk rebelled and after folk carried on, war and poverty funds came through. And my neighborhood organized, my blocks, the rocks around my house organized along the lines of, I don't know if you ever heard of the Sons of Watts. Mm-mm. And the Mothers of Watts. And what they did was organize the so that we could handle the grants coming from the federal government through the War on Poverty. In fact, that was actually my first job, was being a neighborhood youth corps member.
I think that's one of the things that people don't fully understand or appreciate about the War on Poverty, which was based in large part on the North Carolina Fund that preceded it, that it wasn't just about money flowing into communities. It was about organizing so that local folk could actually make decisions about how the money could be spent. And that meant political and social organizing on a pretty good scale at the grassroots level.
I mean, it translated into things that really sound like nothing. But I could actually, you know, wear tennis shoes that wouldn't be pierced by glass, because there was money now to hire folk to sweep the streets to get the broken glass out so we could play in it. We could play on the streets.
Talk about that. And I mentioned the Black Panther Party, but they played an important role in organizing, too. I think your first dental exam happened by way of
it.
It
did. Yeah. Oh, no. The Black Panthers took one of the storefronts that had been closed up and reopened it as one of their headquarters. And they approached UCLA and USC to bring medical students and dental students into Watts to open clinics. So during that summer, they opened a clinic at the local elementary school. Literally, I'm not kidding, literally people lined up for blocks. Mm. To get a medical or dental exam. And that was the first time a dentist had ever looked into my mouth. I, you know, think about going to a dentist. Are you kidding?
Right. Well, tell us more about your family and how they came to live in Watts. They were part of the Great Migration to the West, right?
Yeah, my father left Mississippi. He joined the military, joined the Navy in the 11th grade. He just lied about his age, and he found himself not wanting to go back to Mississippi. And he ended up actually working on the Hoover Dam and making enough money gambling to buy two homes in what was being turned over. Looking back on it, we didn't call it that, but looking back on it, it was white flight out of Watts and Compton. And so he became one of the first black homeowners in Compton and in Watts, and moved my grandmother and brother out to L.A. My mother, on the other hand, came out from Galveston, Texas, but that Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi movement, that's how we ended up in California.
Your father a gardener and your mom a barber, is that right?
Yeah, he started out as a truck driver and moving furniture, and ended up opening his own business by cutting grass and doing the landscaping. And I used to go out with him. It was either that or go to the barber shop with my mother and shine shoes. And seeing how that my brother had that job, I was forced to go out on the truck.
They both emphasized education, am I right?
They did. And for my siblings, we all had choices of Catholic, Lutheran, Seventh-day Adventist schools to go to, because by the time the riot hit, by the time folk rebelled openly, the schools were such where they weren't even safe, let alone teaching anything. So I was the last one in the family, and I went to the school around the corner from my grandmother, which was Los Angeles Union Seventh-day Adventist School. And it was so safe, it had a chain-link fence with barbed wire at the top. And the neighborhood knew that it was the safe place to be, and it was accepted.
Yeah, talk about a mixed message, though. You know it's safe because it's chained off against the neighborhood in which you live. That's a pretty tough message.
Oh, yeah. And everyone understood.
Yeah. And you talked about your grandparents, your grandfather. There's an interesting story there about just, again, his commitment to education and making sure that everybody got an education, teaching her father to read, for instance.
Yeah. They called him Pa, but I never met Pa, but he was a veteran from the Civil War. My father was born in 1913, and so when he came along, my grandfather was literally having him sit on the lap and read the newspaper to him and read his mail to him, and that's how he learned how to read. But I remember my father telling me stories about my grandfather joining Grant, General Grant on the Battle of Vicksburg, and then going up and keeping with the Army all the way into Virginia, but coming back into Mississippi because they gave the plantation to the enslaved Africans who were there, who just happened to be the Mullins.
And they, and of course, he ran away from that plantation to join
the Union Army,
then went back. And you had a choice, I guess. You say there were a choice. You could go to the Catholic school. You chose the Seventh-day Adventist school. Why?
Well, on one hand, it was it was right around the corner from my grandmother, so I could get the excuse of going walking over to my grandmother. And we really hit it off, like my grandmother. But you know, the Seventh-day Adventists also the other reason why is that they promised and they said almost through a threat that there's no fighting here, and I had been in the nursery, kindergarten, first grade, second grade, and the public school, Compton Avenue School. And I just took fighting as part of the daily routine. it was just what you did. Mm-hmm. So when they said you don't have to fight, you know, that was fine. I tested it a couple of times. But
we'll find out more about those tests and how they paid off in the education of Dwight Mullen, a political science professor at UNC Asheville, also leads the State of Black Asheville Project, tracks racial disparities in Western North Carolina. Our conversation will continue on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. My guest, Dwight Mullen, a political science professor at UNC Asheville, who leads the State of Black Asheville Project. It tracks racial disparities in Western North Carolina. We left you at the Seventh-day Adventist school in your neighborhood that you liked because there was no fighting. But tell us about that, because you were, if not the only, maybe one of the very few African-American students in the school, right?
Well, that school was all African-American, but in the fifth grade, for some reason, a discussion which I clearly was not a part of, I was volunteered to desegregate the white Seventh-day Adventist school, which was in Linwood, California. And for 1 year, I made it through 1 year of being in the only one in my class, the only African-American in my class. And it's odd because when in the ninth grade, the schools merged, and the kids from LA Union, the black school, and the kids from Linwood, the white school, were all in the same class. And it's funny, even today, I know where all of them are. Every last single one of members of those classes, I know where they are.
Tell us about that conversation, though, because I'm curious to know if your parents and you talked about political, you know, matters growing up, and whether or not that decision was made for you because of a keen awareness of the political situation that you as African Americans were in South Los Angeles at the time.
It was, and it was, and one of the families, the Wilsons, I know Reverend Wilson, was also a lawyer in L.A., and he let out in these conversations of whether it was part of what we should do at the end of the era of segregation. Should we continue the desegregation of institutions, or should we now use this liberty to build up black institutions? And it was a lively debate, because in Watts you didn't have a choice. White folk weren't coming into Watts, and so building up black institutions became that was not even discussed. Of course we were going to do that. Credit unions, daycare centers, recreation centers, those types of things. But in terms of, you know, your contact with the larger community, what role did you play? And I found myself being in the middle of it. You know, I remember the first discussion, it was in ninth grade, of whether or not we should have a Black History Month. You know, it never occurred to me. Of course you have Black History Month. But, you know, why can't we have a Brotherhood Month? Or, you know, why do we have to be separate? And I didn't understand that was one of the first encounters I had with a liberal resistance to continued racial change.
Well, and maybe an epiphany you might have had earlier, too, was in the fifth grade, again, when you were now single-handedly desegregating the white school. Tell us about that.
Know, I didn't know. I mean, you know, I'm just looking at these kids, and the only white folk I'd ever seen were LAPD and insurance men. You know, those are the only folk who ever came to Watts. You know, so here I am in school with these children, and they're coming back talking to me. I never forget, there were two incidents. One was the Beatles came on Ed Sullivan, And I couldn't for the life of me figure out why these girls in my class were just beside themselves before and then after the appearance. I just couldn't. I didn't understand it. And then that same year, Muhammad Ali fought for one of the championships. And I remember being so excited. And the only thing that people said to me at school that day was, well, he just is a hot dog. He just talks too much. You know, and I was offended at a very personal level that Muhammad Ali was not being worshipped.
Is that because they didn't know how, and was that a kind of a, for you, a sports question, or did you start to see this as a kind of racial distinction?
No, it was clearly a racial thing. It was clearly a racial thing. And it's funny because I remember also having to explain how Muhammad Ali was not offensive to me. Because he was so offensive in the things he said and how wild he acted. Of course, I should be embarrassed. And I wasn't. I really liked him.
Well, then you also got a part in the school play.
Yeah. That was that was another one. You know, the school plays. I was asked to be, I was assigned to be Eli Whitney. Now, I didn't know Eli Whitney. I went home and said, you know, I'm supposed to be Eli Whitney. And everyone in the house turned around and looked at me and said, Eli Whitney. So I found out who Eli Whitney was, and I said, oh, no, this is not going to work. My parents went to the school, and we ended up eliminating that part, and I was just able to sing in the choir that day. So
yeah.
But
it does point to some. I mean, if you think about that time, you're talking about in the sort of late 1960s now, and even the conversations within African-American communities. And then, as you say, the sort of liberal pushback to, okay, you know, that's enough now. Why don't we settle down for a while? Or in an African-American community, should we pursue a kind of separate but equal, strategy here? Or is integration really the way to go? I mean, it was a very heady time, was it not?
Yeah. I remember, looking at the possibilities of opening a grocery store. We were trying to bring a Safeway to Watts, and the resistance behind having a Safeway in Watts. And what they ended up building was a different store, but they ended up having a Safeway that resembled the local liquor stores. I mean, you're talking about bulletproof glass, multiple ways of security of getting in and out. I mean, it was just really interesting. You couldn't possibly take the shopping baskets past the front door or past the car of your, where your car is parked. Yeah. Just a number of things that indicate what they thought of the neighborhood.
You got a good education, albeit maybe some difficult times along the way, and you decided to go to college, right?
I did, and it was again the Seventh Day Adventist stepped in. I don't know if I mentioned this, but when they stepped in, it was the summer that my brother was shot. My brother was killed on a ride-by and in San Francisco, and I had to go up, and the family was devastated. And it was a couple of weeks before my 18th birthday. And I was the one that arranged the funeral. I was the one that did everything because no one else was in a position to do it. My other brother literally had Frank die in his arms. We didn't know that this was foreshadowing what was to come. That ride-bys were to become very, widespread in San Francisco as well as Los Angeles. And the Adventist stepped up in that I was totally not in a frame of mind to go to school. I was supposed to start school within a couple of weeks, first year, first semester as an undergraduate. And they saw to it that I was taken care of, that I was housed the week before school, that I got a ride up to the campus and at Loma Linda, that I was, physically from the repercussions of the drive-by that my family had been involved in. Yeah.
You did go to Loma Linda University, and you were the first black student government president, right?
Yeah. Yep, that's right. I was the year before, I had been president of the Black Student Association, and then the next year I was elected student government president. And as a result of that, I saw a side of things that, again, it was a foreshadow of what I was about to become. in that even in academia, it could be resisted with violence, with the threat of violence. And so that was the first time I remember my life being threatened because of race.
How so? Tell us about that.
Well, the guys, they let me know. There were a couple of bomb threats that for programs that I was organizing. Folk targeted my car a couple of times. Just that kind of thing. So
how are your ideas now beginning to formulate through this period? I mean, again, let's sort of trace this trajectory. We've got, growing up in a neighborhood where services are not provided by the city or by the county. And so people come up with their own ways of protecting themselves. And from the outside, this looks like gang violence. It looks like criminal behavior. But it's a response to neglect by social order. And again, Muhammad Ali, another perfect example. It's okay for African Americans to be entertainers, they can be athletes, but God forbid they should be charismatic and actually capture our attention with a kind of behavior that Muhammad Ali did. They need to be sort of beholden to the community that gave them the right and the chance to be stars. So here you are kind of navigating all of this. You're in a largely white institution and student government president. Are you beginning to have, what's your state of mind politically? Are you deciding at this point you must devote yourself to this cause or not yet?
Well, I was actually divided in that I knew that the African-American community, I knew that they needed me, and I promised I would come home. That's just every semester someone asked me, now you're not going to go off and not bring this back home, and I promised I would come back home. On the other hand, I was also exposed to a lifestyle that I had never seen before. The wealth and affluence that many white folk just took for granted was just... I was not surprised by the behavior, for example, of my classmates with the police or going sailing at Newport. Or I remember for the first time seeing Hollywood and Beverly Hills and realizing that they were 25 minutes away from my house in Watts. And it dawned on me that there's a level of development happening with black people that is far different from the level of development that was happening with my white colleagues and classmates. And so about college, I figured out that what I wanted to do was community development. That's really what I wanted to do, was to figure out how to bring certain levels of economic and social development that was common and kind of just accepted across the United States, at least every place I had seen. I wanted to bring it back to Watts. That's what I wanted to do.
And you're in an interesting position here because you've been to so many sort of white institutions and schools anyway. There is, on the one hand, the amount of time and effort it would take to do that job, and then a need, on the other hand, to bridge these two communities, black and white, at some point, if that's to be successful. How much of that was in your mind, you as a bridge between black and white communities, or you as a sort of full-time developer in African-American communities to bring
about
this business?
Well, it's funny. I would spend my summers in Watts, in Compton. I normally spent maybe one day, maybe one summer away from L.A. But for the most part, I tried to do things back in the community during the summers. But there were two people. Because I was involved with student government, I was able to have access to speakers who came to campus. And there were three people that came to campus that made particular impressions on me. One was Wernher von Braun. I met Wernher von Braun when I was an undergraduate, the Nazi rocket scientist the United States brought in to help, the moonshots. And it dawned on me that evil was real. I mean, it wasn't just my imagination, and it wasn't just LAPD being in a uniform. That evil was just real. Being next to him and spending time with Wernher von Braun confirmed that in my mind. Then I met Ralph Abernathy and Lerone Bennett. I met Ralph Abernathy was, brother, basically, to Martin Luther King. And I was able to spend a couple, 3 days with him. And I met him again during graduate school in Atlanta and at Atlanta University. And the impression he gave me was that the nonviolent civil rights movement was just as gutsy. They were just as militant. They were just as important as what I had always associated with the Black Panther Party. in that the danger that he explained to me and the chances he took with his life, and then Martin Luther King literally dying in his arms and having that explained to me, it moved me in a very real sense. And then Lerone Bennett was the editor-in-chief of Ebony Magazine. I met Mr. Bennett, and we had contacts later in life also. And one of his things that he left me with was that the key to this country is not just race, it's also class. And that race and class across regional lines was so important in terms of structural and strategic maneuvers to avoid the traps of where we had been in the past. In fact, he went on to give me the explanation of, I don't know how he knew I was coming back down south, but he said, you know, the key is if you can get Southern whites and African Americans to agree to something and to move in the same direction in the same organization, this country's nut will be cracked. This problem will be solved. And that kind of gave me a hint about where I was going for the rest of my life.
Well, then certainly there are those who say it is precisely that collaboration and coalition that caused, or the threat of it, that cost Dr. King his life.
Yes.
Desegregating the South for African Americans was one thing, but the idea of bringing poor whites or working class whites and blacks together was the point at which he crossed the line. The other part of that I want to talk to you about is that it takes a lot of organization. Dr. Abernathy talking to you about the power of the nonviolent movement, not only as a tactic, but to organize, to get other people to agree, to sign on. The kind of organization it takes to get people to sign on to that is may really be the power in all of it. I mean, was that something that struck you at the time? Was that getting?
You know, I didn't see it with the SCLC and what they were doing in the South. I came along after their heyday, but I did see the Black Panther Party, and I did see United Slaves, Ron Karinga's organization, US. And one of the things I noted and it stuck with me is that they were never shy about asking for what was considered to be the outrageous. And really, it wasn't outrageous. It was just that no one had ever associated free breakfast for black children or dental programs, that kind of thing.
Tell us about your decision then to go. You were at Loma Linda, and then you went to Clark Atlanta, what's now Clark Atlanta. It was then, I think, Atlanta University, an HBCU. Tell us about that decision.
Yeah. That's when I made my clear decision, was that I had spent enough time on the bridge, and I needed to really be educated and rooted in the African-American intellectual tradition. And at Washington, D.C., through Howard, and Atlanta University in Atlanta, those were the two options that I was told that if you're going to be something, if you're going to do something, you have got to go through one of those two cities. Ended up going through both, but Atlanta was where I chose to go to school, primarily because of it was the only private HBCU that offered a Ph.D. in political science. And the people who had gathered there as faculty for my purposes were exactly what I needed to hear.
And then tell us about your decision to go to Nigeria for a while and work with public policy officials there.
You know, I really wish I could say it was planned, but it just was not. It was the summer after I defended my initial proposal for a dissertation. I had passed my comps and I was looking at writing a dissertation on gentrification. And how that differed from the goals and how that compared to the goals of Model Cities program that was set up by the War on Poverty. You know, how do we get yuppie white folk living in these areas that were once targeted to be model cities for urban living for African Americans? How did that happen? So I was going to look at Washington, D.C. and Baltimore and Atlanta. And my committee chair called me in one day and said, you know, there's this guy from Nigeria upstairs, and he needs to talk to people. We need to have him talk to people so he's not wasting his time while he's coming through Atlanta. And our conversation lasted almost 3 hours. And I didn't realize to the end that it was a job interview. And he offered a position what they were doing is that they had moved back. They had moved into the civilian era, and they had employed the Constitution. The Constitution of the Second Republic of Nigeria involved local government. It in their constitution, they have cities and what we would think of as counties, as having constitutional validity. Mm-hmm. In our Constitution, cities and counties are not mentioned.
Right.
And so the complications of having another layer of government is what I went in to do. And so I was training local government officials and then going back out into the rural areas of northern Nigeria with my students.
We'll find out more about what you taught and what you learned in that experience and how you came to design the project known as Black Asheville, the State of Black Asheville, when my conversation with Dwight Mullen continues on the state of things. He's a political science professor at UNC Asheville, and we'll talk some more after this. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest is Dwight Mullen, political science professor at UNC Asheville. Leads the State of Black Asheville project that tracks racial disparities in Western North Carolina. We left you in Nigeria after you had received your doctorate. Tell us about what you learned and some of your observations about what was going on in Nigeria as they were making a real effort to democratize over there, and kind of what you learned and what you taught.
Yeah, I taught public administration and public policy courses to local government officials who were giving leaves, and they were coming into the university and spending a year, and then I'd go back out into the field and talk with them about how to apply what they learned. But one of the things that I learned is ethnicity and religion were their two big dividing points. And it looked remarkably like what I had experienced as an African-American living in white America. There was no problem, just no one talking about the disparity in terms of social services, garbage pickup, education, health care, those types of things that were supposedly available to everyone. That's just not true. They weren't. It depended on being a Hausa man, or it depended on being a Yoruba man, and what region of the country you're in, and it depended on whether you were Muslim or Christian. And those things affected the outcomes of public policy. It translated into a perspective that I had learned about, and then I accepted as my own at Atlanta University in terms of Pan-Africanism. I truly believe that there are cultural unifying components of black people worldwide, and that once you understand yourself, the application of what you learn worldwide becomes applicable at home. And so the divisions of ethnicity translated into me very well into divisions of race here in this country to help lay the founder for understanding how disparities in public policy can continue.
Those divisions, though, that you observed over there are often used in this country and elsewhere, by policymakers to suggest 'twas ever thus. In other words, these things will always be with us. There's always disparity. There's always a dominant group, and, there's not much you can do about that. And it leads to a kind of fatalism as well, I suppose.
And it's illegal. Because because my feeling was that we decide together as a nation or as a region what we will do together, whether we educate our children together, whether we live together in a community, work together in employment, how we will decide what rules will be and what the rule breakers will be punished. Those things we do together, and for it to be disparately done by ethnicity or by religion or by class violates the idea of rule by law.
You had thought about emigrating to Nigeria with your family. Why?
When we were in Nigeria, it took a while for it to hit me. It was cultural shock. But everybody around me was black. The police were black. The government officials were black. All the students were. It was so confirming. And then as I looked closer at the culture, the things I ate, my sense of humor were repeated and reverberated through the community. And the community, we were in northern Nigeria, basically where Boko Haram is carrying on right now. They accepted us. My oldest girl even started speaking Hausa and had developed an accent.
Wow.
we were there for a little bit over 2 years, and we were acculturated. And then coming back to the United States was equally culture shock. Mm. To see yourself absent in the public image or only negatively depicted was difficult. And then we came back in the midst at the beginning of the HIV breakout and the crack wars.
You did decide to come back. Political instability in Nigeria, I guess, led to your decision not to stay.
Yeah, I had two students who were in from the military academy, a major and a captain, and I helped them and guided their work through, and we became friends. And he just said, "This, you know, the state had gotten too corrupt, and the military wasn't going to stand it, and for me to come back after general elections had occurred, and that Christmas the military took the government." Yeah.
So when you came back here, you ultimately decided to come to UNC Asheville. That was in 1984. Why?
Well, Dr. Rainey, Gene Rainey, really heavily recruited me. And it was the only white campus I applied to. And it was the first campus I heard back from. And I decided, well, let's give it a chance for a year. And maybe things will settle down in Nigeria, or I'll hear back from. And the opportunity to go to one of the HBCUs will happen. And when we got here, I didn't realize that I was in with a group of faculty, black faculty, had been recruited. Five of us had been recruited. The next year, Dr. Dolly Jenkins, my wife, was joined the faculty. And we were there to desegregate the institution. And when I found that out, when I figured out what was going on, that we were part of the consent decree that was signed by the University of North Carolina, it changed my perspective of being in on a white campus.
How so?
It just changed it. It became the microcosm of the home front. And I had to have that explained to me because my mentors, I said, "Man, you got to get me out of here. I can't be on all these people." And they said, "No, you need to stay exactly where you are because the work you're doing is as important as the work we're doing at these HBCUs." And I really appreciated the things that they put in because I thought that they would look down on me for having not returned to the community as I once promised I had.
I mean, this is an important challenge among scholars, African-American scholars, even now, right?
Yes, it is. They've accepted me as a mentor. I really didn't set out to do it, but it's one of the Africanisms that's very much alive in our community, is that elders are still somewhat listened to. Hmm. And I've mentored my colleagues on campus and, you know, actually across the country now, as how to survive in a university, predominantly white institution. Now,
what about just knowing that you're part of this very, very self-conscious, deliberate effort to desegregate? On the one hand, it's a very, you know, so finally we're getting around to it. On the other hand, you know, you're very consciously chosen to play this role. I mean, I wonder how that affected you.
Well, I took offense of people assuming that I had been hired simply because I was black through affirmative action. You know, and I said, "Wait a minute now, y'all, I am hired through affirmative action because y'all won't hire anybody else." you look in the mirror, think you like what you see, and that's what you go hire. And that's not how education works. You know, I'm here in order to force your hand, and I'm going to do the best I can in doing that.
What was it like those first few years there for you?
It was difficult because people were very friendly with me on campus. It was not hostility. It was not yelling and spitting and carrying on. But there was a level of aggression that was in the region that I was often targeted with. I had been involved with the anti-apartheid movement, and I helped organize an anti-apartheid movement at UNC Asheville. And I remember the first demonstration we had was out on the quad. And that Monday morning when I came back to my office, Nazis and KKK members had plastered my office door with love notes. So, you know, and that's when I figured out that Madison County had actually been a focal point of the white supremacy movement. Mm.
Well, you had some other moments there as well. I know UNC system president at the time, Bill Friday, connected you with Duke scholar John Hope Franklin.
Yeah, you know, President Friday and I really, it was the first faculty meeting, and I didn't know how I was supposed to act. When he ran through the numbers, he attended, he was there, and I just stopped him. I just said, "Are you kidding me? What?" I asked a question about, "Could you repeat the numbers for the students and faculty again?" And they said it, and I just couldn't understand.
You mean the demographic?
The demographics.
Yeah, yeah.
And then President Friday afterwards, you know, I asked him more forthrightly about what was going on here. And President Friday looked at me and said, "Well, you just don't come into a man's house and tell him what to do." And then I said, "Well, who built the house?" You know, I mean, so we really hit it off. I mean, it was great. And I didn't know that President Friday actually tracked me for the rest. He knew me for, you know, all through the rest of the time. And years later, we met again, and he recalled the incident and said in passing, you know, I want you to call Dr. Franklin, John Hope Franklin, and ask him to be your commencement speaker. And you tell him that Bill Friday said for you to call. And I had to say, President Friday, I'm nothing. I'm barely an associate professor. How am I supposed to? And, you know, he pressed it. And that's when I met John Hope Franklin, one of my ideological mentors.
Eventually, you created the project called The State of Black Asheville. Tell us how that came about.
It was following Hurricane Katrina. And I had people who had been displaced. And I had people in my classes who were from Metairie, from New Orleans, and they were clearly traumatized. And I needed to understand what was going on with them. And so in a public policy course I changed the curriculum, and we just said, look, if a hurricane hit Asheville, who would be floating in the water? What would that look like? And it led to an examination of what's going on with public policy areas. And we arranged for the students who did the research to find out what was going on with the policies. We arranged for them to meet with the policymakers. And it turned into the first conference. Nearly 400 people were there.
Wow. Yeah. So you're looking at, again, this disparity. What did that look like, that first report? And then how did it turn into an annual project?
Well, we focused on education, but there were reports on healthcare and on housing, and there were reports on economic development and on criminal justice. But most of the data that students were able to generate came out of education and healthcare. And it was so shocking until, you know, we asked, since the schools had been desegregated, since they were under judicial order to desegregate, what were the areas that were being monitored by the courts, and how have we fared from the time those orders were given to the time of the research? And in each of the areas, from hiring to graduation and retention through disciplinary rates, we found disparities by race. This was with the Asheville City Schools. Mm-hmm. We've since enlarged it to include the Buncombe County School System also.
Huge disparities. I mean, the 2015 report, just an unemployment rate, 17% for blacks, 6% for whites. We're talking about Buncombe County here.
Yes.
Talk about wage disparities, average monthly earnings for white folks, $2,100, average white monthly income for African Americans, $1,600. Huge disparities there, life expectancy. Then there's the question of whether or not these are structurally based or just, you know, problems that are happening within an African-American community.
Yeah, I look at them as being structurally based, and I see them as the next stage of desegregation, is that we changed the laws, but we didn't change the administrative rules. We changed how we relate to each other formally, but we didn't address the informal mechanisms within our public arenas. And that's where the change, that's where Buncombe County commissioners, I think, have really stepped up with they just appropriated $500,000 as an investment in the community to help close these disparities using the community's own ideas. We'll be making decisions in a couple of weeks of who gets those grants.
Well, what are some of those ideas? Again, what are some of the ways that you break down the structures? Because they become a dynamic that becomes self-replicating at a certain point. And so how do you sort of crack that open and change the direction of these institutions to get better outcomes?
Well, part of it is it's a much closer coordination between home and school. Another is the idea that learning takes place not just in the classroom, but also outside of the classroom. I mean, a number of the areas, for example, are looking at basic skills and pedagogy, so how those things are happening. How are our children taught, and can we do it in a different way that allows for better outcomes? I mean, those are some of the initiatives that I'm aware of, tutoring, mentoring, the idea of nutrition and healthcare. Health education, all those things that often are segmented in our lives of our children and in our community, but are somehow needing to be unified and coordinated.
Is there an order of operations in attacking these? I mean, you look particularly at education, healthcare, and housing. Those are the three that stand out and where the disparities are the greatest. Again, is there a way to prioritize, or do you have to attack them all at once? And can you?
Yeah. I'm of the opinion that they need to be addressed simultaneously. And right now, we're looking at education and economic development as being primary, but there are also serious discussions with Buncombe County Superior Courts about what will happen in dismantling what we think to be the pipeline to prison. And so diversion programs and expungement programs and alternative sentencing programs in order to keep from building yet another jail are also on the table.
How important are these figures in convincing people who are sort of empowered, right, who are pushing the levers of power, that in fact this is structural, that this is not just some kind of an aberration, that something has to be done here?
Yeah, you know, we tend to introduce ideology too early into our conversation. And so what I have found is that the presentation of this data, the idea that we can identify empirically the problem, is a way of uniting across party lines. For example, Buncombe County voted unanimously, Democrat and Republican, to support community investments in order to close these disparities because the disparities were so stark, so nightmarish, that the problem couldn't be denied. Where we get divisions is, what do you do about it? And there was no division in terms of allowing the community, enabling the community, the resources to address it themselves, along with what we are doing institutionally.
You know, it gets back to some of the war on poverty, which was quite successful when it was allowed to operate. And again, because communities at the grassroots levels came up with their own ideas about how to solve their own problems.
Yeah, I mean, we had a savings and loan, credit union that was opened in Watts. And it was my first bank account.
Money that gets reinvested within that community.
People bought cars. Yeah, people bought homes. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, a return to that based on your research would be a good thing, Dwight Mullen. Good to talk with you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, this was nice. Thank you.
Dwight Mullen's a political science professor at UNC Asheville, and for a decade he's also led the State of Black Asheville Project that includes an annual report on racial disparities in Western North Carolina. You can find links to that work at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton Ormond, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.